I'm Faye Ruscoe. You are listening to Up All Night here on BBC Five Live. And I'm pleased to say it's time for our tech and gadget phone-in, which means I'm joined by our expert, Fevzi Turkalp, from the website gadgetdetective.com. Morning, Fevzi.
Morning, Faye.
Now, if you can find a suitable gadget that works, you can call us on 08085, new number, so I'm bound to cock up answering this next hour, 08085 909 693. Calls are free from mobiles and landlines. You can also text 85058, text are charged at your standard message rate, and you can email to upallnight@bbc.co.uk, and we are at 5 Live on social... We're at BBC 5 Live on social media. Let's start, Fevzi, by talking about, it's really interesting this, your gadget of the week.
Yeah, so it's an unusual gadget. And I had some second thoughts about whether we should be doing this or not, because it's a breathalyzer. It's a digital breathalyzer that you can buy. It's technologically very similar to the ones that law enforcement use. It's got the same type of cell in it that actually detects whether or not. I thought, well, you know, is this going to encourage people to drink and drive? The way that these things are marketed, and I think the sensible way to use them, is to say, no, they're not for people who want to go out for have a few drinks and then test to see if they're road legal. It is for the people who suffer this problem where they've drunk perhaps more than they should the night before and then have to get up the following day and go to work. And if you use it in that way, then that can be quite a sensible way. And it's quite instructive using this device.
My concern would be, well, you know, really, if you wake up in the morning and then you're not quite sure that you feel right, well, whatever the breathalyzer says, don't drive. But also, how accurate are they? Is this just a way of avoiding prosecution rather than being safe? You know what I mean?
Well, I suppose you could whip out your one and counter the police's evidence, but I don't suppose that would get you very far. I think the point is, some people may feel fine in the morning or believe that they're fine and not be. And in that sense, this is kind of an educational tool, because what it allows you to do is understand how your body reacts to alcohol, because it's not just to do with the size of the body, but it's also, you know, how quickly your body breaks down alcohol. So what this thing does is it doesn't just say to you, you're under or over, it does that, but it also then makes an estimate of how many hours it will be before you are legal to drive again, so you can actually see what your body does with alcohol. In that sense, I think it's very good. As I said, it uses a professional fuel cell for its accuracy, and it's also quite interesting because one of the things you do is you put in the country that you're in, which, by the way, includes Scotland as opposed to the rest of the UK, because Scotland's got a substantially lower drink drive limit than the rest of the UK. So it's kind of useful in that way as well. It's easy to use. It works a lot like a traditional one. I think it's worthwhile. It's £149.
That's what I was just going to ask. What's the difference between this one and, because there are breathalyzers already on the market, aren't there?
Yeah. So the difference is accuracy, essentially, and ease of use. So, for example, when you're blowing into it, it actually coaches you. So if you're doing it incorrectly, it sort of gives you on-screen instructions on how to do it right. And again, that makes all the difference in terms of getting an accurate reading. So I think it's the sort of thing, if you use it as it's meant to be used, which is, you know, for instruction of yourself, so you understand how your body reacts, and also for testing in the morning, then I think that's wonderful.
£149, though. You've got a drink quite a lot to be... I would want to get my money's worth out of that, and to do you would be drinking quite a lot.
Yeah, you know, when you get your money's worth is when you avoid a fine and 3 points or more on your licence. At that point, I think it represents value for money. So interestingly enough, there are actually, I think in France, there is actually a requirement to carry, it's not this, but what's called a single-use breathalyzer. You actually have to carry one in your car by law whilst you're in France. This doesn't meet that requirement, but it is interesting that the view of sort of breathalyzers is somewhat different across Europe, depending on, you know, where you are and, you know, what you do with it, as it were. But I think it's a good thing used in the correct way. One downside is these things need to be calibrated or recalibrated every 12 months. So you actually have to send it away. So it's not a, you know, a low cost option, but I think I think particularly, you know, this idea of biofeedback where, you know, you try and measure or, you know, some aspect of yourself, and we're increasingly, you know, tracking our heart rates, our movement and our sleep and so forth. I think actually it's quite instructive to just understand what happens to your body when you take a drink drinks or three.
I can see that, but I have to say, putting the driving aside, if I was drinking so much that I was wanting to measure my alcohol level on a, you know, the morning after, enough to be able to get my money's worth, I would be worried. I would be worried about my drinking habits.
But then that's a good thing, isn't it? If you measure yourself and find, you know what, you're actually over the limit or close to the limit, it maybe is a wake-up call to, you know, address how much one has drunk the night before. So better not to drink in that sense, I guess.
Yeah.
But I do think it's instructive because, you know, all these things about, you know, how many drinks you can have, those are just guidelines. And we know that it varies between men and women, for example, typically. But there are many other factors that affect how we metabolize alcohol. So I actually think, you know, with my scientific type hat on, I think it's a good thing. I'd be interested, as it were.
Let's move on to the these credit cards that are getting even more technologically advanced by MasterCard. Tell us about these.
Yeah, so this is a new payment card, as you say, from MasterCard, which includes a fingerprint sensor on the card itself. So
it's all very Mission Impossible, isn't it?
Well, yeah, so, this is part of what they call biometrics, using some part of you to add security. So in this case, fingerprints, we got some devices, for example, that scan your retina and so forth. And it's all very Mission Impossible. It's a good thing, I think, in the way that it's being implemented, because it adds a layer of security. I wouldn't want to rely upon a fingerprint in the place of a pin code for a couple of reasons. You can't really change your fingerprints. We can change pin codes and make them secure. And if we think someone might have got hold of it or something, or, you know, something happened, we can actually just change it. But you've still got the same set of fingerprints. The most that you could do is, change which finger it responds to.
But why would you want to do that? Because if no one can get into no one can use your card unless they've got your finger.
Well, No one can use your card unless they've got your fingerprint. And you know what? We leave our fingerprints all over the place. It was quite interesting that, as soon as devices started using fingerprints, they showed it. They basically used a piece of tape to lift a fingerprint off a surface. And in some cases, they could just apply it to a piece of sort of latex and so forth and use that as a dummy finger.
So you could get into somebody's phone, for example, by using the method you just described.
Can I mean, there's a bit more to it than that, but yes, essentially you can. So where it's a what they call second factor, so where it's in addition to a password or a pin code or something, it's potentially a good thing. Because it just adds a layer of difficulty to a fraudster. But just be aware that none of these things are foolproof. The card itself is quite ingenious because the card, you might think, well, how does a fingerprint reader work in a card? Mm. Does it have a battery? Is there space for a battery to run a fingerprint reader? And it doesn't have its own power supply. It uses induction from the local terminal. So the terminal will beam out waves that will energize a coil in the card that then give it a sufficient power to take and transmit a fingerprint.
Amazing.
So it's a clever thing. It's the way things are going. I mean, I would say that, there is a similar system to this at the moment where, for example, if you've got an Apple or an Android phone, you've got Apple Pay and Samsung Pay and Android Pay, where you upload details of your card into the phone and then you need to have your fingerprint on the reader before that will work. Now, the reason why I like that is, first of all, it's much better than just contactless, where if you drop your card, someone can just pick it up and use it on a normal card. So fingerprint either on the phone or a card itself is a good thing. So in that sense, it's good. But the way, for example, the Apple system works is particularly ingenious, because when you make a normal transaction with a card, the vendor, i.e. the shop or wherever you're spending money, gets your card details, and therefore, you know, you are somewhat vulnerable. You can have your card replicated or the details replicated and fraudulently used. However, when you use, for example, Apple Pay, it never actually gives the vendor your card details. Your card details go up into your phone, which is then protected by passcode or fingerprint. But what the vendor gets is like a token, a promissory token that says you will be paid, and then they are paid. But what they don't get is your card details, which is great, because one of the ways in which our card details are often compromised is not just at the time of transaction, but because they're sometimes held by vendors on their computers insufficiently scrambled fashion. So actually, something like using an iPhone for making payments is, at least in theory, more secure than the card itself.
Do you know, I have Apple. I managed to organise Apple Pay on my phone about 9 months ago. I haven't yet used it. One, because I forget it's there, and two, because when I do remember it's there, I panic that I'm going to do it wrong, and the person in the shop is going to shake their head and think, "You fool! You can't even use Apple Pay."
It's quite neat. You know, sometimes. Sometimes it usually works first time, but sometimes it's possible to start it up but not have put your fingerprint on it, and then it will just it will object. But actually, it works remarkably well, and my experience is that it actually works better than the card itself, because sometimes the cards become a little bit damaged and a little bit jaded, you know, a bit rough around the edges, as it were, and they don't always work so well, and you know, sometimes you have to replace cards because they become physically damaged. With this, it's not any more convenient because you don't have to carry cards for day-to-day use, but it's a little bit more robust as well. I guess we tend to take a little bit better care of our phones than we do our cards. So there can be benefits. So I think this sort of idea has got legs, but we shouldn't think that fingerprints are foolproof. They're not. And so they're, in my opinion, only suitable as a second factor of authentication, not as the primary one.
Okay, questions are starting to come in. 08085 909 693 or text us 85058 if you've got any questions for Fevzy. Let's start with this one from Stuart, who says, can you explain how 1Password works and is it free? I don't know about this.
Okay, so 1Password is a category of software called passwords management software. So 1Password is very popular. Another popular one is called LastPass. They do very similar things, and which is this: the problem that they're designed to solve is that as we access lots of different online services, we're told always have a password that's unguessable. Don't write it down. Oh, and by the way, make sure it's different from every other online service that you use. So, you know, most of us use upwards of 30 or 50 different websites if frequently or infrequently. And we're expected to carry unguessable, you know, 30 to 50 unguessable passwords in our head. Now,
It's
not going to happen. And that's why you have a problem, because people then tend to use either the same password across many services or, you know, guessable variants of it, you know, where they just add a number of changes at the end or something like that. That doesn't work. So password management software, what it does is two things. First of all, as you surf the internet, it's sitting in the background, and with the first time you go to use a service or when you want to change a password, it will generate for you an unguessable, inhuman password, if you like, not something that relates, a random combination of upper and lowercase letters, numbers, and if you want it to, other special characters as well. So it does that for you, and it stores those in a vault. You don't actually ever have to see or know or remember what those passwords are. It stores it in a vault, which is then password protected. So you only have to remember one password. Now, we mentioned before second factor authentication, because if you stopped there, it would be rather tricky, because if someone got that one password, then they'd be into your vault and have all your passwords. You know, single point of failure is what that's called. So what you then do is have a second factor authentication. So that can be, they have to send a text to your smartphone at the beginning of a surfing session, which you then type in, or it could be your fingerprint on a reader, or it could be a little USB dongle type device, looks like a little USB memory stick that goes into a USB slot. Any of those things mean that even if someone's got your password, they still can't get into your vault because they'd need the other physical thing as well. So once that's all done, the beauty of it is that you can just surf the internet as you wish, either on your phone or on, you know, any other internet enabled device. And as you go, it will just automatically type in those unique secure passwords for you. Those passwords are stored encrypted by 1Password and LastPass, so nothing is completely secure. And I never used to like password management software, but it just changed because the number of websites getting hacked and the number of people who'd use the same password all over the place was just too painful to watch. So with this system, on balance, it's, I think, more secure, more practical, and actually brings the fun back to using the internet because you're not stopped and asked to show your papers, as it were, at every junction.
Sorry to interrupt, Fevzi. Can I just ask, what do the banks think? If your bank account was hacked and you were using a service like this, what would their reaction be? Would they be happy for you to use a service? Would you be in trouble?
I mean, that's a very good question. I would say that, banks may take different views about it, but I would say it's a sensible precaution, and they would have to show that you'd been in some way negligent, because their terms normally talk about you having been negligent with your password. So if you, for example, lost your bank card and you had a post-it note with the number on it and both went at the same time, the bank's fraud guarantee probably wouldn't cover you because you hadn't taken reasonable measures.
Okay.
If you've taken measures designed to increase your security and somehow someone has got around them, I think you'd have a very strong argument in that respect. So I think they're a good thing. If you do it with the second factor, they're great. Are they free or not, I think, was the other part of the question.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these applications have a free version and then have a paid-for version that you can subscribe to.
Now, that worries me. If is the free version rubbish?
No, it's not. They've got the same underlying security. It's more to do with convenience. So, the variety of devices that you can use it on, that sort of
thing. We've just had a text, actually. Jack in Brighton has just texted in, but you lose all this if you use other computers. So the paid-for version you wouldn't.
No, and in fact, some free versions even give you that. It's normally bells and whistles that you get. The core functionality is there. And no, you know, the whole point is that you can use it, as we tend to use the internet, on multiple devices now. And you can have different vaults for different users as well. So, husband, wife, whatever, children could have their own vaults as well and have security from each other. But, I mean, the joy of it is you then have, let's say, you're with one bank, that bank gets hacked, and you've used that password somewhere else, that's a disaster. With this system, you've got unique passwords for every time, and you can reset those passwords at will. And the other really good thing is when, let's say your email gets hacked and you've used the email across various services, now you've got a whole list of all the websites where you've registered with that email, because that's what your vault effectively is. It's a database of all the places you're registered. So it makes it much easier to go and change everywhere that you've used it, because you've got an up-to-date record of it. So in terms of disaster management as well, that's a good thing. The only other tip that I'd give people is, in addition to using a different password on every website, consider using a different email address on every website. So that's like doubly safe. Well, that's not as.
How many email addresses do you have, Fevzi?
Well, there are tools that you can use to generate, effectively fake email addresses. They're real in that any incoming email to that. So let's say I wanted one for Amazon, then I could have it as amazon.xyz@blurb.com, whatever, and I could set that up, and then that could then point forward any emails that went to that to my real email address, which is never published on the website. The reason why that's a great idea is if, let's say, a provider that you've registered with gets hacked, if that email address is has the name of the website within it, you will know that they've got hacked because you'll start getting spam on it. And that's really instructive. I've used that system, and I've learned of many companies who've clearly been hacked and not told me or anybody else. But I know it's happened because I've suddenly started getting a deluge of spam on that particular email address. When that happens, I can just delete that temporary email address, put in another temporary or fake one, and redirect that. That gives you a second tier. That's quite a sophisticated use, but that's really much more secure, because then you've got unique password and unique email address for each. And your password management software will track the email as well as the password for you.
Richard the Milkman has sent me what I'm sure will be my favourite text of the evening. He says, remembering passwords is an odd thing. As someone who was about in the 60s, I used to remember dozens of phone numbers with no problem. We all did, in fact. Of course we did. Weirdly, I can still remember most of them now, and yet I can't remember passwords at all. What's that all about? What is that all about? That's just, I mean, he's right, isn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Funny.
I mean, it can be for various reasons. One is that, you know, a purely numeric passcode, it can be more memorable. When I used to dial numbers as opposed to have, you know, speed dial type services, I could remember several hundred phone numbers.
Yeah.
But I remembered the reason, I realized the reason why I did it was because I could remember the pattern that my finger traced on a keypad. And it was the pattern that I remembered. And how I knew that was the case was because when I went to Denmark for the first time and their keypads were in mirror image, the top and bottom rows were reversed numerically, suddenly I couldn't remember any phone numbers. And the way I had to do it is I got a mirror and I held it up to the keypad and looked at my finger in the mirror, and then it worked.
Brilliant.
So sometimes it's that, and it's like visual memory that some people, for example, when they're playing a musical instrument will... you know, hands on a piano keyboard, for example, will remember this, what they call muscle memory, that the hand feels in certain shapes on the keyboard, as it were, as part of how a piano can be played. So I guess it can just be because, you know, one, it's numerical, and two, we may remember shapes and so forth, but it's much harder to do that on a keyboard. But again, people who remember things like how to type words on a standard QWERTY keyboard, typewriter keyboard, if you change the order of the keys, if you gave them, say, a French keyboard, which the top line is not QWERTY but is AZERTY on a French keyboard, then you suddenly find that you can't type anymore because the muscle memory is wrong. The keys are in the wrong place. So I think it's partly to do with, you know, the shape of the keyboards that we use.
Let's take a call now. Good morning to Phil in Leicester.
Hi.
Morning, there. Sorry to keep you waiting, Phil. You've got a rather freaky question.
Yeah. I've got a shower speaker.
Yep.
And the Bluetooth one.
Yes.
And obviously I play radio stations and music from my phone, which is in the lounge, through to the speaker.
Yep.
Everything's fine. A couple of weeks ago, I bought a brand new microwave oven, and now I find that if the microwave's on, it interferes with the signal to the speaker.
Yeah.
That's the most bizarre problem, Phil, I think we've ever had phone into the programme.
Actually,
I didn't know what it was at first, because obviously I'm in the shower and everything's fine, and then all of a sudden it just started fuzzing out and cutting out and coming back in again. Because I had the microwave on a timer, and then I realised what it was when I switched the microwave on straight away, and I realised it was the microwave. But the phone's in the lounge, and obviously the speaker's in the shower room, and then the microwave's in the kitchen, which are three different rooms.
It's a fair distance, isn't it?
But they're all on one level, but you're talking about a sort of like a 20-foot radius.
Yeah.
Phil, Phil, just so that you don't feel alone, Richard Foster, who's reading the news for us at 5:30, has just walked in, and Richard says to me he's got exactly the same problem. Richard, the same thing happens to you, Richard.
It's the very same thing. You try to you put on your Bluetooth speaker, which in my case is connected to my phone. And if I'm and it's probably the bad sort of place I've got. They're badly situated in the kitchen because my microwave's in one place and it sits. The Bluetooth speaker sits on the microwave, and I put the phone next to the Bluetooth speaker in the microwave. And when one is on, when the microwave's on, then the signal can get very, very dodgy indeed. It just cuts out, and you have to sort of reset the whole thing.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well, what's the solution?
I found the solution. The solution is to move the phone into the bathroom next to the speaker.
Yeah, which is not ideal if the bathroom's getting steam in it.
It's getting steamy. I mean, that's why I left it, you know.
You could move it just the other side of the door, perhaps. I mean, look, so this is not a very uncommon problem, and you get all sorts of devices interfering with each other. So we live, our homes are sort of this sort of electro-smog of all different frequencies bouncing around, both from outside in terms of things like, you know, mobile phone towers and so forth. And you might, for example, have noticed how your Freeview goes on the fritz every now and then because there's a pulse from a 4G tower nearby, and you have to get filters to cut that out. So what I believe is happening here is that the microwave oven is producing radio frequency interference. Some will do this more than others, and that's interfering with the radio frequencies that are you know being used by Bluetooth. You can try and put distance between it, between the microwave and the handset, as you've discovered. That's probably the most practical solution, or just don't microwave when you're in the shower, ideally. But, you know, if you really need to. There's not much you can do on the Bluetooth front in that Bluetooth doesn't give you sort of separate channels. So, for example, Wi-Fi is interfered with by, say, a decked phone or a baby monitor, cordless phone or a baby monitor, you can at least switch to different frequencies within the standard. But Bluetooth doesn't allow for that. You could, for example, reconfigure, set up a system where it didn't use Bluetooth and it used, let's say, your home Wi-Fi. And you could actually route music over the Wi-Fi network, and there's lots of devices that will help you do that. That's a possibility. One thing I would do, by the way, and it's not indicated by this problem particularly, but I think it's actually not a bad thing to do. You can buy quite cheaply monitors to see if your microwave is leaking microwaves themselves. So it shouldn't be. If you look at how a microwave oven is constructed, it's actually what's called a Faraday cage. It's a metal cage that keeps, that's why things on the outside don't cook or shouldn't cook. And it, right down to, if you look at the glass very carefully, the glass front door, you'll see a little mesh, wire mesh actually built onto the glass. And that's all part of the Faraday cage, because if you didn't do that, then the microwaves would shoot straight through the glass and injure our health. I actually think it's worth investing in a meter just to see if there's any microwaves leaking from that device. And I would also say that not all microwaves do this. Some seem to be better screened than others. So if my one was bleeding radio frequencies all over the place in terms of, you know, interfering with my Bluetooth, I'd also be inclined to just stick a microwave meter on it to make sure it's not leaking anything more nasty as well.
Okay.
Sort of the less well-constructed ones tend to give this problem, I would say.
OK, Phil and Lester, thank you very much for your call. Richard Foster also taking notes there of your help, Fevzi.
You're listening to a BBC Five Live podcast.
If you like this, you might also like this.
Eye of the Storm with Emma Barnett.
Every day we're covering some sort of storm that changes people's lives forever. To find out more about our range of podcasts, click, tap or swipe bbc.co.uk/5live.
I'm Faye Rusko, and we are back with the Tech Phone In and our gadget detective, Fevzi Turkalp. You can call us 08, it's a new number, I just can't say it, apologies. Our newish number, 08085 909 693. Calls are free from mobiles and landlines. The text number, thank goodness, hasn't changed, 85058. We're also at BBC Five Live on social media, and the email address, upallnight@bbc.co.uk. Lots of questions coming in, so let's rattle through a few of these. Fevzy, have you come across, Richard Hill in Worcester wants to know, have you come across the OnePlus 3 phone? If so, what's your opinion?
So this is a smartphone. It's the third in a series of very good phones for the money. So they're top end phones, and they're remarkably cheaper than a lot of their competition for phones with similar specs. One of the ways in which this is done is to try and cut out the actual retailer, and they sell them directly. And I think that can be a slight issue, because although you may be protected legally, it's sometimes nice to have a retailer as well as a manufacturer to go to with problems.
I was just going to say, so if you have a problem with it, you're stuck.
I wouldn't say you're stuck. You're dependent upon them. Whereas if you've got, you know, a high quality retailer that sold it to you, they have an obligation to you as well. So in that sense, I think it's great. I mean, it's a fantastic time for smartphones generally, in the sense that you can get phones much cheaper than that one that are more than enough for people. So I would say, if you want and need the various bells and whistles that handset brings you, because it is a high-end phone, then it is very good value for money. The build quality seems to be okay. The feature set is definitely there, but you know, there are other phones as well that you can look at as well. You know, on the Android side, look at something like the Google's own Pixel phone, for example. That's an excellent device. That's arguably the best Android handset that there currently is this week. And similarly, you know, you can always consider the Apple kit as well, and look at something like a iPhone 7 or 7 Plus. So they're the same sort of category of phone, but the OnePlus phone is much cheaper. So it can be a way to go, and particularly these days, because people, if they have a sufficiently good warranty and they're only planning to keep it for a couple of years, then you might just take the chance and say, yeah, I'd rather take the money I save and put that towards my next phone, even if it means I end up buying it a little bit sooner. So I think it's a sensible choice, but I would look at the alternatives as well. It's not the only choice out there, and particularly some people buy phones with far more features than they need. And yep. So the other thing might not just to go for another top-end phone, but say, do I really need, am I really going to use those features? And, if not, then go for something cheaper, because you can get substantially cheaper phones that are just amazing in terms of what they do compared to even a year ago.
Mm. Speaking of a year ago, John in Scotland says, what's the best Bluetooth speaker for use with the Amazon Echo Dot? And also, has the Echo improved since it launched? Was it last year it launched?
Yeah, the Echo has improved. So this is that sort of speaker device that you can speak to. It streams what you say to Amazon's computers. They come up with the answer and stream the answer back to you. And it's great. So it's had a lot of functionality. We've had a lot of fun with the Echo on this show in the past, asking it all sorts of Easter eggs, like, yeah. Are you evil and do you know hell and all this sort of thing. And it's got lots of film references in it. But it'll do things like traffic reports, weather reports, news reports. And for a long time in this country, it's been able to read audiobooks as well. So from the Amazon company Audible. And that's been really nice. But one feature that's been missing till about, I think, a week ago, was the ability to read ebooks. So not audiobooks, but actually just the ebooks that you would normally read on a Kindle, for example. And now it will do those, and it does the text-to-speech conversion, that's to say the translation from the written word of the ebook into speech that you hear, on this is remarkable. It's much better than you get on, say, even an Apple device, where they have screen readers on Apple devices, so it will read you an ebook off that device. It's really quite good. Normally, listening to text to speech is painful because the intonation and the timing is all wrong, and it's kind of painful because your brain's having to work three times as hard to actually track and understand what's being said. Amazon have taken a real leap forward in this, and it's impressive. Of course, it's still distinguishable from a human speaker, but it actually gives people a viable alternative to having to shell out extra for the audiobook versions of titles. And particularly, audiobooks aren't available for all titles, whereas the ebook version of a title usually is. And so particularly good for people either like me who just like being read to. It's great, you know, before you fall asleep, or even in the background when I'm working. I often have an audiobook, you know, going, or now an ebook going. So it does keep improving. So the hardware remains the same. But Amazon are particularly good at retrofitting new features into the same hardware. And I'll give you another example of that. Those people who've got a first generation Fire TV box or Fire Stick, so those are the devices that allow you to watch internet TV on a normal non-smart television set. Those devices are in the process of being retrofitted with new software that allows them to act like Amazon Echo boxes.
Okay.
And the really nice thing about that is all the Echo boxes, the Echo and the Echo Dot, only connect to the internet via Wi-Fi, which isn't always the best thing.
No.
But if you've got an Amazon Fire TV box, which is a little, you know, set-top, tiny little set-top box, that can connect via wired internet, via an Ethernet cable. So it can actually do something that the standard Echo boxes can't do. In terms of the speakers that you can attach, well, first of all, you've got two versions of the Echo, the big one with the nice speakers, so the thing that looks like a half-used kitchen roll on its end. That one doesn't allow you to connect an external speaker either wirelessly or wired. So it has a nice-ish speaker in it. You know, it has a speaker with a sort of bass speaker as well.
But you can't improve on it.
No, and particularly it's mono. So if music is your main reason, you don't want that. Ironically, the cheaper Echo Dot, which is like literally it looks like a cut-down version. It's only about an inch and a half high, I think. That one gives you the ability to either connect via a wire to an external speaker system or wirelessly to an external speaker system. So although it has got a much more basic speaker in it, which is only really good for speech, not so good for listening to music, it has the feature that its big brother doesn't have, which is the ability to drive external speakers. Mm. My favourite, I mean, it depends on how much space you've got and so forth, but my favourite
choice. The
difference
is price is quite substantial as well.
It's about
£100. It's about £100 cheaper, yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, you could get, if you wanted a small setup, you could get something like the Hive 2 speaker system, which is lovely, very good value for money, small stereo speaker pair. If you wanted to get big speakers that give you proper, you know, what they call bookshelf speakers that gives you proper stereo separation, and you want the choice of having different ways of connecting it to it, wired or wireless, for example, then something like the Kitsound Parallax speaker set. And I think that they're a little over £100, but they're fantastic speakers. They look like a pair of studio monitor speakers. They're the size of, you know, the ones that normally go on a bookshelf. Those ones are a three-trick pony because you can have a wired connection into it, you know, auxiliary input. You can have Bluetooth feeding the speakers directly, or you can have an optical input. And why would you want an optical digital input? That's a very good question, Faye, I will tell you. The reason for that is if you wanted to have the sound coming out of your TV being fed through a good pair of stereo speakers, almost all modern TVs have got an optical audio output on them, which give you high-quality stereo sound output.
I'm glad I asked that question.
I am glad you asked the question. It was very insightful of you. I'm very impressed. So that, you know, built. So we've had these sort of big speakers for, you know, for decades, frankly, but they've now retrofitted them with the sort of the wireless technology and the optical digital technology. And for a little over £100, I think that they're a bargain. They're called the Kitsound Parallax. There are many other good speakers. And also bear in mind, if you've got an existing hi-fi, you might even have one left over from the 70s or 80s or whatever, which are, you know, great amps, great speakers. If you've got a spare input on that ancient amp, you could feed that with your Echo Dot device, for example, and it will sound fantastic.
Okay, let's go to a caller now. David in Leeds. David, how can Fevzi help you this morning?
Hi there. Well, I hope you can. I've had a bit of a problem. I got someone claiming to be from TalkTalk talking to me after I'd reported a slight problem, and they talked me through a whole lot of things on my computer.
Yeah.
And we went. I've written all this in detail on an email to you if you want to read the details of it all. But just basically, my computer's ended up getting completely corrupted. I've had to reinstall Windows from the disk, and the problem being that I bought the disk some time ago with 7, and then I upgraded to 10. Now, I thought I'd done a Macrium backup on the 10 installation, and I can't access it. So I'm just wondering, now that I've reinstalled 7, is there any way to do a free upgrade to 10?
Okay. David, can I just take a step backwards, just because there's a couple of questions I want to ask you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
You said you spoke to someone that you thought was TalkTalk. Is it now your view that that wasn't TalkTalk?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd reported a fault on my television a while back, a few weeks ago, and they arranged for someone to call me at a certain time. They did.
Yeah.
Then they couldn't solve it on... It was only a very basic fault, and they couldn't solve it on the telephone, and they sent an engineer around, and he couldn't solve it, and then I hadn't heard anything from them. And then someone phoned up just about a week ago now.
And they got lucky because you had an outstanding issue and you thought it was them.
Well, I think that they have hacked in, or as I...
Okay, so by whatever means.
They were trying to get my bank details, in any case, eventually. The end result is my computer was unusable. Yeah. I've had to reinstall Windows 7.
Okay.
And I need to know if there's any way of getting that upgraded back to 10.
I understand. Well, the short answer is yes, there is. But what I'm more concerned to find out, if you don't mind me just sort of probing this, because there could be a bigger fish that we need to deal with here.
Yep.
Do you believe that you gave them control of your PC at any point during those conversations?
I do. There was something called Team Viewer. They got me to download Team Viewer.
So you've given them remote access to your PC. Okay.
Yes.
For anyone listening, and now, Dave, you know this, don't give people access, even if you know who they are, even if you're a blood relative, do not give them remote access to your computer. I'm sorry.
Yep.
It's just not worth it. Let them talk you through it. If you think they're genuine, let them talk you through it. But the first rule is make sure you know who you're talking to. If they claim to be from TalkTalk, just take their details and then... Don't ring them back on the number that they give you. Look up the number independently and deal with it that way. And by the way, don't use directory inquiries on the same line, because sometimes they keep the line open and pretend to be directory inquiries.
Well, so, when I went to the bank, they said, you know, put the phone down and don't phone anyone for 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, I'll preferably give them a mouthful first, but then put the phone down. So we have to... look at what we can do to protect you first, because potentially the least of your problems is getting Windows 10 instead of Windows 7. Okay, what we need to do is secure all your online activities. The first way that you need to do that is, for any email account that you operate, you need to go in from another machine which is thought to be clean and uninfected and change those passwords on the email account. That's essential, because if they've had access to your system, they may have gotten access to your email account. Why is this important? The reason why it's important is because, you know, as you use different online services, let's say banking or shopping or whatever, almost every website where you have a username and password account gives you the ability to reset the password on the basis that you've forgotten it. So what they'll normally do is send a reset code through to your email address that you use to register. If that has happened and they have the ability to read your incoming emails, then what they can do is reset the passwords on your online banking or anywhere you've given card details for shopping and gain access to those accounts and therefore spend your money. So this is the area that I would look at first, more than worrying about your PC at the moment.
Okay, well, first thing I did was go to the bank and they suspended, and I got them to suspend my internet banking. So hopefully anything that goes, I only use internet banking off of one account. So hopefully that's semi-resolved all of that issue.
That's some of it. But have you ever, for example, bought anything online where you've entered card details?
Yes.
Yeah. And in some of those cases, for convenience, have you allowed that website to store your payment details so you don't have to enter?
I don't think so, but I can't confirm that for sure.
Well, that's kind of important. Look, I think you've been duped and your machine has been breached. So changing the password is a no-brainer. There's no reason not to do that.
Fortunately, one of the things that I don't do anymore is save passwords. I always keep them all in on paper in a book, yeah, and enter them, and I never save them on the computer.
Yeah, which is great, because some people would just stick it in a word processor file unencrypted, and that would be disastrous. The problem with writing them down is, of course, if you know someone has physical access to your home, if you've got people, you know, coming in and out of your house for any reason, you know, working in your home, you know, some people have carers or cleaners or whatever, and I'm not impugning any of those reputations, but, you know, there is the physical risk of if it's written there. And that's why when we touched on password management software before, you can see how that sort of software helps prevent the fallout of this sort of situation. So change that email password, then change the passwords on any other service that you use. And again, having password management software makes this easier. But make a list of everywhere where you've registered using that email account, and change all those passwords as well. It's a pain. You'll spend about an hour or two writing down and trying to remember everywhere that you've been. You'll get most of it. You won't get all of it, but get the biggest bits. Anywhere that you've done shopping is a priority. And change all those passwords as well. Ideally, set up a whole new email address. So if it was, let's say, a Yahoo account, go set up a Gmail account or something like that, and change those as well. It's a real pain, but that's why I would say to you, now is probably a good time to consider using something like LastPass or 1Password going forward, because as you're going to change all this stuff, why not use a tool like that to generate secure and unique passwords for you, as you're going to end up changing them all now anyway. Now, I know that that's a pain and you could just do nothing and get away with it, but I would be really remiss if I didn't ask you to make those changes. And this is a bit like if you've lost a key and you don't know where it's gone, changing your locks, because it's just possible that someone picked it up and you dropped it outside your house and therefore they know where you live. So I would do that. I'd use something like LastPass, 1Password, regenerate your password starting with your email account. Now, moving beyond that, do that first and don't worry about Windows 7 and Windows 10 for now, because this is the priority. Then what you need to do is you can actually download still a new version of Windows 10, and you will still be able to enter the key from your original Windows 7 in that, and it should work. So you can still do what you did before.
Okay.
Because you did it for the first time as a free upgrade within the 1 year, you're still entitled to use Windows 10 using your Windows 7 credentials. So you can do that, and you can download it directly from the Microsoft website. Okay.
Thank you so much for your call,
do
David.
Do the other stuff for us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Faye, sorry, but I took the time because that's something that is affecting so many people, and it can be life destroying.
Yeah, no, I can totally understand, and your heart sinks, doesn't it, when you realise that you've been duped with something like that.
Some of them are so convincing, and they scare people. They get them even to go to cash points and withdraw cash and give it to a courier or their cards to a courier, and it is heartbreaking. These people are scum, which is why I feel okay about giving them a mouthful as well before putting the phone down.
Jason has been in touch as well. Just a quick question, wants to know what the services are called for setting up those temporary email addresses for redirecting that you were talking about earlier.
Okay. You know what? There are several of these. The one that I use is no longer accepting new customers. So
it's that popular. That's interesting.
Yeah, because it's quite labour intensive and they don't actually charge for the service. So I will put that up on Twitter later on. At Gadget Detective, because I just need to do a bit of research to see which are the good ones now, because the one I use is no longer available for new customers.
Okay, so gadgetdetective.com is where to look once you've researched those. Jackie from the Isle of Man wants to know, what's the best external hard drive to get to back up mainly photos and documents from a laptop? Good but not too pricey, and are they difficult to use? We've got about 90 seconds.
I don't think you need to worry too much. You know, the quality of them is pretty good generally. What you need to think about is some of the specifications. So if you need to back up a very large amount of data, then you're probably still looking at a conventional external hard drive, i.e. that's to say one with moving parts that spins round, because although they're not as quick as the solid state drives, they have a higher capacity and are cheaper still. Then you have to think about, do I want a great big one that has to plug into its own power supply, which will tend to be faster because it will rotate at 7200 spins per minute, rotations per minute, or can I be doing with a little small one that's, you know, a bit bigger than a couple of credit cards. Those can be what's called bus powered. They don't have to have a separate power supply. They're powered from the computer that you're backing up. Most people go for the smaller ones and they have sufficiently high capacity. If you don't need a super high capacity, then get a solid state backup drive because they are much faster. So those are the things I'd look at in terms of brands. There isn't that much to choose and it would be complicated to take you down much further.
Same as the phone situation, I suppose, isn't it? Don't get something that, you know, with capacity that you don't need.
Well, but except that they get, you know, you don't know what you need so much on that because you may do generational backups or extra backups. So just get as big as you can afford without it, you know, hurting, as it were, in financial terms.